My name is David Ryan. I'm the interim coordinator for Free Thinkers at UU Sarasota, and I would like to welcome you and thank you for responding to our invitation to attend today. Our Free Thinkers briefings are evidence-based summaries of what the general public needs to know about complex issues in the fields of religion, morality, ethics, and justice. Today, our speaker is the Reverend Frank Schaefer, who is a United Methodist minister. Frank is in the process of being defrocked by the United Methodist version of the Inquisition. When he was asked, by his gay son to officiate at his son's wedding, Frank had a dilemma. If he performed the ceremony, he would violate church law, but marrying his son would be an act of love. Frank's courageous decision was that love conquered this discriminating law. Frank's trial thrust him and his cause into the national media. He is here today to tell his story. Our custom has been not to collect money for speakers' causes. However, today, if any of you would like to help this minister without a job, there is a container on the back table for your donations. We'd also like to give special thanks to the Gulf Coast Affirming Interfaith Network, which did all the work to get him to Sarasota and Venice and had a wonderful turnout last night in Venice. And we're grateful that we can tag on and give this opportunity to those of you who have come today. Frank, you're up.
Thank you so much for that. Good morning. It is wonderful to be here with you this morning. And they gave me a lapel mic, so I can roam this morning, so which I like to do. That was a wonderful introduction. Thank you so much for that. I'm honored to be here today and to speak to you. And one thing I noticed right away when I came, and this is a very spiritual place. This place is so friendly and welcoming, and you just want to sit here and meditate or do something. It's a beautiful place. So thank you for inviting me here to this Unitarian Universalist Church, correct? Yes. I don't even know where to begin, but let me begin by saying that I really appreciate the verse in the Christian Bible that talks about perfect love drives out all fear. You know, for most of my life in the United Methodist Church, I sensed that fear. I was fearful of speaking up. I was fearful of affirming publicly my gay children. And I have three gay children. Three out of my four children turned out gay. I think God wanted me to get a message here. He wanted to make sure that I really got the message. Somebody asked me once, what was that like on Thanksgiving? Did another child come out each Thanksgiving? Or how did that work in your family? Well, it didn't quite work like that. It was actually kind of odd the way it happened, at least the first one. I was sitting in my church office at the Avon Zion United Methodist Church in Lebanon County, and I received a phone call, and it was an anonymous phone call. A lady from the community called me, and she wanted to remain anonymous. She did not identify her name. And she said, Reverend Schaefer, I have a very serious message for you. Please listen to this. I must tell you that your son is struggling with his sexual orientation. He is gay, and he is considering suicide. And I remember this message just instantly put me into a surreal state. It's like there was so much shocking information, I couldn't process it. I hung up the phone, and I was in this weird state, and I remember being in denial. Remember thinking, it can't be. My son is not gay. I know my son. And I had seen no signs whatsoever. I drove home, talked to my wife about it, told her about the whole conversation. My wife, too, was in shock, and she just could not believe that our son was gay herself. Now, I have to tell you, I was already tolerant at that point in my life of gays and lesbians in the church. I even was tolerant of of gay rights, gay marriage rights, and the right to become ministers. But it was still like a knife through my heart. Even though theologically I was already there. But to think that my own child was gay, and this was in the year 2000. Now, talking to David this morning, this was not the 1950s where it was really bad, but the year 2000 was still, you know, very hard for gay people to live and to be accepted. And I just had a really hard time with it. So we decided we must talk to our son. I mean, if this is true, you know, we have to talk to him. He needs help. And so we asked him, Tim, I got this phone call from this lady. Is it true? Are you gay? And he said, yes, it was true. It is true. I'm gay, he said. And he had been struggling. And then he told us his story, and it was just so heartrending for my wife and myself. He said he had gone with me to an annual conference, and I remembered that event at our church in the Eastern Pennsylvania Conference. And it just so happened that year there was a debate on the floor on homosexuality, and it was ugly. It absolutely turned ugly. I remember microphones being lined up, people lining up behind the microphones, and it went back and forth. It was a horrible situation and a horrible discussion. What he received that day was a message that said to him, "My church thinks of me as a freak. My church is saying that homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching." Somehow he felt like his salvation was questioned. And it threw him into a very bad place, in a very dark place. He became very depressed because faith had always been very important to Tim. He had been very active in the church. He was a model PK, I always say. You know, he had been active in the youth program. In fact, he went to two different youth groups, in my church and another church. And he was so into music. He played the piano. He played the drums on the worship team. And I always say he had the most extensive contemporary Christian CD collection of anybody I knew. Faith was very important. And so when he received this message from the church, it devastated him. It really devastated him. Now, my wife and I did notice that he was depressed. But, you know, he was 15, 16, and we thought, well, you know, he's a teenager. You know, we noticed when he came home from school, he would lock himself in his room, didn't even talk to us. And we thought, well, maybe we'll just give him a room. You know, he's going through a phase, a teenage phase or something. But we didn't know what was going on behind the scenes. He shared with us that he cried himself to sleep many nights, praying to God, "Please take this away from me. Please make me, quote unquote, normal." And when that didn't happen, he thought it would be better for his dad, the minister, and for his family, his community, if he were gone. He had already put a plan in place. And the only reason why he didn't follow through is because he had one person, one single person he really trusted. And that was a girlfriend that he had, and it was her mother who called me. When he had shared all this, and while he was sharing this already, we had just tears running down our cheeks, my wife and I, and we just hugged him and told him, "Tim, we love you so much, and that's never going to change. We will always love you, no matter what." And I remember asking him, and I tried not to make this a guilt trip or make this sound negative, but I asked him, "Why didn't you come to us? Why didn't you trust us?" And he said, "I wasn't sure. I was pretty sure you were going to be accepting, but I wasn't sure, and I just knew I just couldn't handle any rejection from you." And so his plan was, or had been, to tell us once he went off to college to be in a safe place. I just can't even imagine what my son went through. You know, the darkness that he must have experienced, the anxiety, the confusion. I mean, to hear a message from the church that questions your salvation, you know, that That's just so harmful. And so when my son asked me in 2006, he called me. He had met Bobby, and they had been together for a year and a half to 2 years. And when he asked me, "Dad, would you do the wedding for me?" I was overjoyed because I was so proud of him. He had become a young man who had accepted himself for who God had created him to be, a gay man. And he was happy. And he found Bobby, and they were really good together. And we liked Bobby's family, too. And so I was like, I'd be honored, son. Of course I will do the wedding. And it was only after I hung up with him that I thought, now I have to figure out what that means for me and for my career in the United Methodist Church, because clearly I knew that the United Methodist Church forbade and still forbids gay marriage. And so immediately I experienced this fear again that I had, you know, sensed so many times. This time it was very much pronounced because I stood in the tension between the love for my son on the one hand and the love for what I did, being a minister in the United Methodist Church on the other. And I came to the conclusion after praying over it that I had to be perfectly transparent and honest about it to my bishop and the cabinet. I concluded that if I would get fired for taking a stance, then so be it. Then I would have to do something else. And so I did. I put this in writing on my profile form that was due every year, and I put it in, and I expected a phone call any day after I did so. The only thing is, nothing happened. I didn't hear from my bishop, didn't hear from my district superintendent. So I thought, well, I guess that means they're okay with me going ahead and doing this wedding. And so I did. In 2007, I performed this wedding between my son and Bobby. It was in a restaurant. It happened in a restaurant in Cohasset, Massachusetts. And it was a beautiful event. It was a beautiful ceremony. And I say that because it was filmed, and I just recently watched it again. And it was a beautiful and touching ceremony. And after the ceremony, we had great food in this place. And then we had a party, and it was a beautiful party. 6 years, almost 6 years after the wedding, I did hear about it. One of my parishioners at the church found out about the wedding. It had been rumored. There had been a rumor about it for a long time, but there was a quarrel in my church. And as a result, this parishioner drove up to Massachusetts, to Boston, Massachusetts, went into the courthouse, and retrieved the certificate of marriage with my signature on it, filed a complaint. 26 days before the statute of limitations would have run out. 26 days. I almost made it, but not quite. And again, this fear came back. This fear of what would happen now, what would happen next. And it was a struggle. It was very, very painful. Up to this point, I had not been very open in my theology, expressing my theology to my church. I had taught in subtle ways. And my message had always been about the inclusiveness of God and how we should accept every single person as a child, as a beloved child of God, that we should greet and welcome anybody. And as a result, we did as a church. And it was a beautiful thing. Actually, word was out into the community even that I had 3 gay children. And so we had a number of gays and lesbians coming to our service, and some of them became members, and it was a beautiful thing. I remember one Sunday, we had communion, we were celebrating communion that Sunday, and I noticed that one young lady was in the service that had just been dismissed from the hospital, and she and her partner were at the service. This young lady had just been dismissed, and she had a severe condition. She had some sort of stroke, and she was debilitated in her movements. And it was interesting, she could only take a step if she actually said out loud, I've never seen this before, if she said the word step out loud. So when she said step, then she could actually take a step. Step. And I still remember this so vividly. When we called up for communion, now I would have come to her to give her communion, but she didn't want to. When we called up for people to come forward to communion, she came forward. And she came saying, step, step, each step of the way. It was so important for her to come forward and receive communion. You know what that did? It changed many people in my congregation that morning. There were tears in people's eyes. I talked to one lady that was known to be very conservative on this issue, and she said, I will never judge a gay person again. When I saw how important her faith was, I couldn't hold my tears back. And so we had wonderful things happening at our church. But I think those wonderful, what I consider wonderful things, were considered to be evil things by others. And it was a group of perhaps 25, 30 people in my church, many of whom had already left the church some time ago, but were still active somehow behind the scenes, became very political, who just could not stand the fact that there were people like that coming to our church. And it threw us into this crisis as a church. The complaint was filed. Now, the word of the complaint was made known at a congregational listening meeting on May 2nd. Initially, I was very hopeful. There was a lot of good responses that night, even from some of my conservative friends. I remember one of my conservative friends getting up and saying, but it was his son. We have to understand. We have to have grace. It was his son. And another person got up and said, you know, had he not done this wedding for his son, I would not only think that he's a bad father, I would think he's a bad pastor as well. And people blew me away. I thought, well, this is really wonderful. This is good. However, most of these conservative friends of mine, and they were friends. You know, if you pastor at a church for 11 years, you become friends with the people. But most of them had thought that I would apologize for what I did. They thought that I didn't really think it was a good idea to marry gay people, that I would apologize and receive forgiveness from the church and we all move on. Once I was asked about my theology, I could not lie. And that's when I lost a lot of that initial support and things really turned ugly. You can't imagine how horrible it is to really see a church split, to see the split going through friendships and families and the ugliness of it and the accusations and just the ugly things that were shared and the way people hurt each other. It was a horrible, horrible ordeal. And I still mourn, you know, this time and the division that was going on after having been there for 11 years and really trying to build the Church of Christ in the right way. It really was very painful. And then at the trial, you know, it was also significant that those who were in opposition of me at the local church, they all were there at the trial. They sat behind the prosecutor's bench, and all my supporters sat behind the defense's bench. And it was hard to see that. You know, it was a visible sign of what had happened in our church of Iona. At the trial itself, this was one of the most bizarre things I've ever gone through. It was in many ways like a trial, like a civil trial. You know, there was a bench where the judge sat, who was a bishop, there was a jury. There were 13 United Methodist ministers sitting over to this side, and then there was the prosecution and the defense, the table for the defense. And then there were people in the audience, about 150 of them. I have to tell you, I was so grateful for so many supporters showing up, not just from my local church, but from all over. Word had gotten around. And the way I could tell was these people wore rainbow-colored stoles, many of them. And there was a sea of rainbow-colored stoles in the room. And looking out, I was just so encouraged by that. And when I first came to the trial, when I walked up to this gymnasium, it was actually held at a church camp in a gymnasium, there were protesters outside. And I was fearful that I would get attacked, but these protesters were all pro-LGBT protesters, and they were so awesome. They cheered, actually, when I walked up into the gymnasium, and they wished me God's blessings, and they touched me, and they prayed for me, and that felt really good as well. So in many ways, all these years that I lived in fear that this might come out, in fear that my theology would be discovered, in fear that it would have consequences for me and my family, you know, all of this, in a sense, started to change with all of those supporters that I never knew were there. Because I lived such an isolated life in Lebanon, and I thought I was, you know, one of very few people that thought pro-LGBT, that were progressive. And it makes you feel really isolated, and makes you feel really badly inside. And when I saw that support for the first time at my trial in such a vivid and in such a powerful way, you know, I started to think, wow, there are others like me. There are many others like me, and it really feels good. On day one of my trial, I was actually not allowed initially by the judge bishop to put on a defense. The only thing he allowed me to say in the witness stand is, yes, I performed this wedding. But then my counsels had a great idea. They said, Frank, let's just ask you in the stand about your person. Because none of the jurors were supposed to know me. Had they known me, they would have had to recuse themselves. So they said, we're just going to introduce you as Frank Schaefer, you know, the person, you know, the father. Tell about your family, tell about your calling to ministry, tell about your ministry itself, and then see if you can't sneak in the whole story and a defense. And that's exactly what happened. Thank God for lawyers. Sometimes they're brilliant. Yes. And so this amazing thing happened in the witness stand, where I was actually able not only to talk about myself, my family, my ministry, but I told the story of my son that I just shared with you, and how the church doctrine had hurt my son. And then I was even able to quote from a parable, the parable of the Good Samaritan. And I said to the juror, I said, you know, my son was just like this person in the street being beaten up. And I had to help him. I could not pass by on the other side of the road like the priest and the Levite did. Because, you know, they had to stay ritually clean. They couldn't get blood on them because they were on their way to Jerusalem to perform services. And they were under a ritual law. And I may have violated a ritual law. I may have become ritually unclean. But isn't this what Jesus told us in this parable? That we have to be neighborly and help this person in the street. And it was my son. This person was my son. He had been hurt and harmed by the doctrine of the church. I needed to help him. And I tried to explain to them that had I said no to my son when he asked me to perform his wedding, it would have negated all of those affirmations that I gave him That when I said to him, you are created in the image of God just like everybody else. You are a beloved child of God, gay and all, and God is proud of you, of who you are as a gay man. It would have negated all of those affirmations. And I told them, there comes a time when you have to walk the walk and not just talk the talk. And that was my time. And I got all of that in. And then when I sat down, the Council for the Church had a closing statement. And that statement turned so hateful and ugly toward not only gay folks, but also toward the jury. He actually said to the jury, if you don't find Reverend Schaefer guilty, you will have to answer for yourself. And he threatened them with hellfire and brimstone. It was so bad that I heard a noise behind me, and I turned around and I saw that all of my rainbow-colored stoled friends were standing in protest of what they were hearing. And the Council for the Church noticed it too and turned around and said to the bishop, Bishop, aren't you going to stop them? And in a moment of grace, Bishop Gwynn said, no, you're almost at the end. Just continue. And allowed them to stand in protest of this horrible speech. So at dinner, I sat with my councils and I said, well, I feel good. I wasn't supposed to get any defense in, and I did. And then we had this really hateful statement by the Council for the Church. And I said to them, how big would it be if I got acquitted? I was very hopeful. My council said to me, Frank, it would be huge, but it's not going to happen. And sure enough, that same night, later that night, when the jury entered the room and they avoided eye contact with me, I knew that that wasn't good news. And I was found guilty. And I want to just share with you this, that there, I thought I was prepared for this verdict because I thought, well, it's likely that I'd be found guilty. But I wasn't really prepared. You can't emotionally and spiritually prepare for a church that you have served for 20 plus years, that you have embraced as your faith tradition, together with your family, to tell you you are guilty for performing an act of love for your son. You can't prepare for that. I was devastated. But there was another day of trial. Day two of the trial, it was all about the penalty. In a church trial in the United Methodist Church, it is up to the jury to find a punishment and a penalty. So on that day, I was allowed to produce some witnesses, and I had wonderful witnesses. I remember Thomas Frank, Professor Thomas Frank was there. He is the foremost capacity and expert on the Book of Discipline. And I was so impressed by him. In cross-examination, when the Council of the Church tried to trip him up, you know, he was quoting sometimes. He had, oh, I know where that is. And he just leafed around in the discipline and he found what he was just quoting. He knew the discipline from front to back. And I was so impressed by that. And he said some wonderful things on my behalf. He said, you know, the United Methodist Church is a big tent. There are many, many diverse people that are a part of the United Methodist Church. And we've always been proud of that, he said. And because we are such a diverse people, we have contradictory statements in our Book of Discipline. Because besides paragraph 2702, where it talks about the prohibition to marry gay people and for gay people to become ministers in the United Methodist Church, there are also parts in the Methodist Book of Discipline that talk about the sacred worth of all people. And it is set in the context of talking about homosexuality. And it says things like ministers, United Methodist ministers, are supposed to minister equally to all people, regardless of gender, nationality, race, ethnicity, of socioeconomic status, and sexual orientation. And when he said all those things, I felt justified. And I felt good, and I thought, had he only been allowed to testify yesterday, maybe I would have been acquitted. And then my son took the stand, And that was very hard. It was very emotional. When my son shared his story of how he was hurt by the church and how he was at the brink of suicide, I just lost it. I just couldn't keep my tears back. When I heard it from him, even though I had heard it many times, but in this situation, when he told the big bully his story, I knew it was very, very hard for him, and I was so proud of him. You could have never told that he was intimidated. He told his story with passion and with courage. I remember Rich Kirk. He was in the crowd, in the audience, a friend of ours, and he's the vice president of the Reconciling Clergy in the United, Eastern Pennsylvania of the United Methodist Church. He listened to my son, and he was totally resolved in tears, because he, as a 70-year-old gay man, was so touched by his story because it was his own story. And Rich told me, that was me. That's exactly what I experienced. And he was so sad and devastated because here he witnessed this 40-year younger man sharing his story. And the reason he was so sad was because he thought, here we are, 40 years later, and we haven't changed a bit. The same thing is still happening in the church. People are being harmed. Now, leading up to my testimony that I had to give on that second day, I still felt that fear that I was talking about. And that fear centered around losing my job. I didn't want to lose my job. I didn't think I could afford to lose my job. And so my lawyers, my attorneys, counsels had helped me to come up with a statement that was very political. And it was very carefully crafted in its wording. They said, don't say it like this. Use this word and avoid this. And so when I was supposed to be cross-examined, they coached me. And they said, if the counsel for the church asks, will you promise never to do a gay marriage again, just tell them, I can't answer that question. It's a hypothetical question. Nobody can predict their actions in the future. And so it depends. And, be very evasive and political. Don't make a big statement in your last testimony. And at first I was okay with that. And I believe it was because of that fear that I still felt. But I was not okay with that statement. And I just knew in my heart of hearts I had to tell the jury how I really felt. In fact, I was a little bit angry because as my son spoke, he told me later that none of the people really paid attention to him. The counsel for the church, they were like talking. The people in the jury were not even looking at him. And I was like, here we go again. The church is just not listening. We are harming people. We're hurting people. And the church is still not listening. Why aren't they listening? I was so conflicted. I remember during this break, lunch break it was, I went to my cabin. We each got a cabin and it had several rooms and we slept in bunk beds. It wasn't the most comfortable, but it was okay. I went into my room in the cabin and I started praying. And I prayed out loud and I didn't even care if anybody heard me outside the door. I just needed God to hear me. And I said, God, can I really do this? Can I defy the church? And I asked God, is this what I have to do? Is this why I feel this way? Is this what you want me to do? And then I raised questions up. I said, well, Lord, what about my paycheck? What about my security? What about My two children who are still in school and need my support. What about my health insurance, my family's health insurance? What am I going to do tomorrow if I'm going to be defrocked? And at that moment, it was like God directed my thoughts to Jesus Christ. And I think it's a natural thing for Christians to go there. And I thought about Jesus and his sacrifice in a different light. I thought, you know, Jesus didn't just give up his career and his security. He gave up his whole life. His whole life. Everything. And I thought about other remarkable people in history. I thought about Jan Hus in church history. I thought about Martin Luther King Jr. And I thought, wow, you know, these people gave up their lives for what was right. And it was an act of love. And suddenly, giving up my career and losing my job didn't seem as big. And I had this feeling, you know what, I'm going to be all right. And I was in the courtroom. And at that point, I got really nervous because I had no script. And I wasn't sure whether the words were going to come out in the right way. And I started to scribble down words and sentences on a scrap piece of paper. And I felt sick. I felt sick to my stomach. And you know, when you feel sick to your stomach, you feel weak. And that's how I felt when I took the stand too. And then something incredible happened. I looked up to look at my wife and my family, my son Tim and my daughter Debbie, they were there. And then I looked at them and I looked at the people behind them, you know, dressed in rainbow-colored stoles. And I looked at them and I could see them look at me intently. And they were, there was love in their eyes and support. And somehow it was like I felt their prayers and I felt strength returning to me. And it was amazing how these prayers lifted me to a place where the words just came out. And I really attribute the Holy Spirit for giving me the right words at the right time to speak. And I looked at the jury and I said to them, you know, if I'm going to be a United Methodist minister tomorrow, before you make a decision about that, I need you to know that I will not discriminate against anybody. I will not refuse ministry to anybody based on their gender, nationality, race, or sexual orientation. And the church has to stop to judge people based on their sexual orientation or anything else. And I'm here to tell you that I can no longer be silent, that from now on I will have to speak out on behalf of God's beloved children in the LGBT community that are being harmed by the doctrines of the church. We have to stop discriminating and treating them as second-class Christians. We have to stop the hate speech. And then I took out a stole, and I actually brought this stole with me today. This stole had been given to me on day one of my trial by my lawyer's wife, Ann Ewing, and it actually has her name on it, and a phone number. Oh, wow. I have her phone number now, too. She gave this to me. She said, he gave it to me, but he said, this is from my wife, and she wants you to have this. And I said to the court when I took it out, you know, I don't believe that things happen without reason. I believe I've been given this stole today. And with your permission, Bishop, I'd like to put it on. And the bishop gave permission for me to put it on, so I put it on. And I said, I want you to look at this stole. And I talked to the jury, because this stole is a visible sign and a symbol that I will from now on be an advocate for the LGBTQ community within our church and beyond. And that's all I have to say. I can't even begin to describe you how I felt. I did not feel badly at all. I sat down and I was in some sort of a Zen state. not only was I at peace, but it felt like that fear that I had sensed for so many years, the fear that kept me in place, the fear that kept me silent, was gone. Perfect love drives out all fear. And I did not care in that moment whether I was defrocked, whether I was not going to have a job, whether I was not going to have security and health insurance. I didn't care about any. It was like a huge burden had been lifted off my shoulders. I was free. I was free. I think I was smiling. And I'm not sure. I think that was probably confusing to the jurors, but I felt free. A burden had been lifted. Perfect love drives out all fear. That's what I experienced at that moment. It was an act of love for my son when I performed his wedding. It was an act of love for my son and for all LGBT people that I performed in this courtroom. And I stripped myself of all of those fears. It was a beautiful moment. The verdict that came back, the penalty, was very strange. I didn't know what they were saying, to be honest with you. One thing was clear. They gave me a suspension. They said, you're suspended for 30 days from all ministerial duties, starting right now. And at the end of the 30 days, they said, I would have to tell the Board of Ordained Ministry in an interview that from now on, I can uphold the United Methodist Book of Discipline in its entirety. And they put it in the context of my new calling that I had found to minister to the LGBT community. So clearly, they were basically saying, we want you to denounce gay marriage at the end of the 30 days, because that's really what it meant. Of course, I could not do that. But I also made it very, very clear to the Board of Ordained Ministry a month later that I would not voluntarily surrender my credentials. And I told them, I can't do that because, first of all, I believe this is an ordination that God has given me, not just the church. And secondly, I cannot turn my back on my brothers and sisters in the church that are being discriminated, the LGBT community. And I told them how I'd received hundreds of letters, emails, Facebook messages of people, of LGBT people, that told me, do not leave us. Do not give up your credentials. And so I told them, I'm here to say I will not voluntarily give up my credentials, as I was asked by the court, but I can also not uphold the discipline. I'm here to tell you that we need to change those laws and the discipline. Well, the chairperson of the Board of Ordained Ministry said to me, well then, in other words, then redeem your credential surrender. And I said, no, I made it very clear. I will not surrender my credentials. And then she said, well, then we're taking them from you. And I said to her, well, what does this mean? Do I have to give you my certificate of ordination? Because I had it in the car. I didn't bring it with me into the room because I wanted to hang on to it as long as I could. And she said, oh, no, we're going to just do that administratively. You'll just be expunged from the books. After 20-some years of ministry in the United Methodist Church as a faithful minister, I was expunged from the records. And I remember sitting in the car in the parking lot of the conference center. My wife was sitting next to me, and she said, Frank, look at your hand. And I looked at it, and I was trembling. I was shaking. I was visibly shaken by that action. Even though I kind of saw it coming, I was still visibly shaken, and I was depressed. Wouldn't you know, though, on the very next day, I received a phone call on my cell phone from Bishop Minerva Carcano from the California Conference. And she said to me, Frank, I have talked to many pastors in my conference. I've talked to my district superintendents. I've talked to other bishops, colleagues here in the Western jurisdiction. We want you to know that we stand 100% behind you. We believe that what you did was in the spirit of Jesus and true Christianity. And I'm inviting you to come over to California and minister in one of my United Methodist churches. I said to her, Bishop, you didn't just make my day, you made my life. The same church that had rejected me and expunged me on the previous day was now inviting me back. I felt so great. And at that moment, I knew that I had to remain in the United Methodist Church because there was more work to be done. This instance alone shows how big the division is within the United Methodist Church. And now that I'm traveling across the nation many, many times to United Methodist churches that are reconciling, that are open and affirming, I see the tremendous support that's there. There is a grassroots movement afoot in the United Methodist Church that is so encouraging. I feel like we're at a tipping point. I feel like we're at that point where we can come to driving out all of that fear in the name of love. We're so close. And so I rejoined a United Methodist Church the very next Sunday after I was defrocked. And I joined the Foundry United Methodist Church, a very progressive church who have traditionally been fighting for gay rights for many, many years. In fact, they became a reconciling church. And this congregation, the SPRC committee, put a document in place that every new pastor has to sign that says you will have to do gay weddings in our church. How amazing is that? That's the church I became a member of. And it sent ripples through the United Methodist Church. In fact, that service, my sermon that Sunday, was streamed live on the internet and reached, I was told, thousands of people, because a lot of United Methodists were shaken at what happened to me at the defrocking and were tuning in and were listening to what I had to say. And I asked everybody in this sermon, everybody who was on the fence, I said to them, don't leave the United Methodist Church. We need you. If all the good people left, there will never be change. We need you to help us change these horrible laws in the United Methodist Book of Discipline. We need you to change that homophobic language. The harm and the hurt has to stop. And so I go around, traveling around, with my message of inclusiveness and God's love and how perfect love drives out all fear. And I'm hoping that when we get to the year 2016, at next General Conference, that there will be a historic moment when we change that discipline. That's my prayer. And that's my hope, and that's what I'm working toward now. Thank you so much for listening to me tonight.
I think they liked it. This is our time for questions, and I will handle the roving mic. If you just raise your hand, we'll try to do it in the order that you raise your hand. Questions or comments? Okay.
My name is Eleanor Altman, and I have a transgendered son. And when he was 2 years old, I didn't know he was transgendered, but I thought this child was gay. At 2 years old, I could see signs. At 3 years old, he said, "My name is Jeffrey." At 4 years old, he wouldn't wear a dress. So I saw signs very early.
Wow. Was that helpful to you in dealing with this?
I accepted this child as a lesbian. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I see. Yeah. So in some ways, it was actually helpful to you to see those signs. Yeah. We did see signs in our son Kevin as well from pretty early on. Not that early, but from pretty early on. And so when he came out, first of all, it wasn't a big deal because, you know, he knew that we were totally fine with it, you know, from dealing with his older brother, of course. And then when he came out, it was like, yeah, and what else? You know, so we knew about that. But he still had to come out. One funny anecdote I want to share here is that, you know, we have four children. Three of them are gay. The first three are gay. And so it's kind of interesting how my son, my youngest son, Pascal, we were wondering about him all these years. Oh, is he gay too? Is he gay too? You know? And so he actually felt compelled to come out as straight in our family. I think that's very unusual.
I was going to ask you about, because you mentioned there were three of your children that are gay. You've told us how two of them came out. I guess the straight one came out as well. How about the fourth one?
Yeah, you mean the third one, the third gay one, right?
Right.
Yes, yes, yes. That was our daughter, Debbie. And that was more, I was so encouraged because by the time Debbie came out, she came out last, she was so open with us and so trusting, and she knew she could trust us. And so she actually openly told us about her struggles. You know, at first she thought she may be bisexual, but more on the heterosexual side. But, you know, she had trouble dating, and whenever a relationship would become more physical, she just shied away, and she didn't know why. Because she liked the guys she went out with, but she just couldn't figure out what that was. And so she thought, I think I may be bisexual, but more on the heterosexual side. And then after a few weeks, she said, well, I may be more on the lesbian side, actually, because I really am attracted to this one girl. And so we saw the whole development with her, and finally she came out as lesbian, and that has stayed, you know, for many, many years now. But it was so awesome as a parent now finally to see a child being so trusting, and that she would just, you know, really involve us in this process of her struggles, and we were there to help her and to, you know, to encourage her, and that was a beautiful thing.
Another question here.
Hi, good morning, Dr. Bola. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I have two questions for you. One is, don't you think there is one oxymoron that in your church, do you accept gays as members, but you don't accept the marriage between the member of your church?
Yeah. Yeah.
That has no sense.
Well, that's
The second question is that you go to different things and concepts about God that we don't know what it is, or Christ or whatever. You don't think that really the church should be the church of men and not the church of something else?
I am not sure I understand the second question, if you could elaborate a little bit.
Yeah, you're talking about different messages and things about the church of God or church of Christ and so on. Mm-hmm. But really what you're talking with the social problem that we have and so on, really the church or churches are the churches of men. Not a church of anything else.
Yes, yes.
Here on earth.
Yes, now I understand. Yeah. And now I forgot the first question. Boy, my memory is not what it used to be. Oxymoron between... Oh, yes, 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 yes. And that is exactly why I said we're treating our LGBT brothers and sisters in the church as second-class Christians, because we are saying you can be a member here. You can be baptized. You can even become an active member and be on our committees or teach Sunday school. But when it comes to marrying the person you love, no, we don't allow you to do that. And if you want to be a minister, no, we don't allow you to do that either. So we give them some rights, but when it comes to certain ceremonies, certain other rights, we say no. And that clearly is discrimination. And that doesn't even make sense to me, even from that perspective, you know. It doesn't make any sense. Because if you are baptized in the Christian tradition, you know, baptism really should give you the right to be a citizen of the kingdom, you know, and with all the rights and duties that come with it. So it doesn't really make sense, even from that perspective. And secondly, absolutely. You know, I always say, well, yeah, these are the doctrines of the church, but they do not represent Christ. They represent the church, but they do not represent Christ. So yes, in many ways, I totally agree with you. You know, a church, any organization, religious organization, is really man-made, and we are far from, you know, from having a true representation in terms of an organized religious form. And maybe the UU comes closest to this, actually, if I come to think of it. But you know, we're a far stretch from that in the United Methodist Church.
Next question's here.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm curious, as you give talks around the country, as I'm reading you, do you get groups of people in your audience who are opposed to the opposed to your message, and how do they respond?
Actually, I do. I do get that. And I have to say, for the most part, they really behave and they're really respectful. And I do get critical questions then oftentimes from the audience. But that's okay. I actually like to engage them and I like to talk to them and talk about specific issues that they have, because I really think I can be helpful to them, because, you know, I also have evolved from an evangelical, you know, to a progressive Christian. And at one point, I was taught by my church that homosexuality is a sin, and I believed it as a young man. You know, and it took for me many years to really get to a point where I became not only tolerant but an advocate. And I remember as a young man, you know, talking to my very first openly gay person that I ever met, and I was thinking, well, I could be friends with this guy. He was so nice and so interesting to talk to, and for the very first time I noticed there was a difference. So I come from that background. I understand where they're coming from. I know all the scriptures that they always cite, and so I like to engage with them on those and really give them a different perspective and hopefully help them along the way. Now, one time I actually faced a protester at the Lebanon Valley College. I was speaking there, and outside there were three protesters with picket signs. And that was the first time I saw my name on a picket sign. That was kind of interesting. And I actually engaged in a long talk with two of them also. However, that ended up not so well, because I kind of lost my cool there at one point, because they really got under my skin. But yeah, for the most part, in a setting like this, you know, there's usually a very, very nice talk. So yeah, I do face them.
Next question's here.
I'm curious about your plan B if in 2016 things don't quite change with the doctrine. Will there be a faction that splits off from your church, or you're not even thinking that at all? But I kind of think that there should be a plan B, because there are those, you know, the large group of staunch old timers, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, by 2016, first of all, we still have a little bit of time. And what I'm observing is that, you know, things are changing so rapidly in society that the tension is really growing, you know, and our grassroots movement is really growing fast as well. I mean, there are more and more churches becoming reconciling in the United Methodist Church. One of the problems that's been pointed out is that the United Methodist Church is a global church, and unfortunately, a lot of the delegates from African conferences and some Asian conferences are very, very conservative on this issue. And that's the part of the church that's growing the fastest right now, or it has been for many years. And so the delegations get bigger and bigger from those parts, and that could be a problem. But there are different solutions already on the table. Some are saying they're moving to put a motion on the table to have the United States have their own central conference, just like Africa has a central conference, Europe has a central conference, every part has a central, except for us, and everybody gets to vote on our issues. So that's one way to maybe get around it and come up with our own version of the discipline, so to speak, here in America. That would be a good first step. But you're right, even with all those plan B, C, and D, it seems very difficult. So I do pray that we will see change, and I do hope, and actually I'm positive about it, but I am very much aware of the fact that if there won't be a change, that there will probably be a split. So I'm sort of thinking about that, and I'm thinking, well, before we just go back to business as usual, I would rather see a split, you know, because something has to give. Something has to change.
Our next question is from the Voice of God.
Yeah, that's what they call us. You mentioned the United Methodist Church in Africa and in Europe. Europe is either Catholic or Lutheran to a large extent. How large is the United Methodist Church in Europe?
I don't think it's very big. Of course, the Methodist Church in England is large because that's the birth country of Methodism through Wesley. But that's not under the United Methodist Church. They're independent. We have a bond, and we do send delegates to each other's general conferences, but it's not under the umbrella of the United Methodist Church. So the United Methodist Church is rather small in Europe, but it is rather large in Africa and parts of Asia. So the Europeans, I don't think, have much of a say or an influence in general conference.
Frank, could you give a summary of whether those laws have always been in the discipline, or were they mm-hmm. added in the last 50 years or something mm-hmm. of that nature? And if so, there have been other votes, I assume, supporting same-sex marriage that failed. Mm-hmm. What has been the trend of those votes over time? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you have that all handy, but it seems mm-hmm. to me there's probably an increasing support for what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And how far is mm-hmm. it from reality?
Actually, I wish I could say there has been increasing support, and that probably has behind the scenes, but the United Methodist Church's hierarchy has never really acknowledged that. And so all our efforts in the past to change the discipline, to change those discriminatory laws, have failed. But in the last couple of general conferences, we have tried to tone it down and just to get them to include a statement that couldn't be more true, that said, we are not all one on this. There is a minority, a sizable minority, that disagrees with those homophobic laws. And even that was voted down. And so the United Methodist Church's hierarchy has always said, well, we're the United Methodist Church. We don't really have a problem with this. You know, we're pretty much one on this, and have sort of like swept it under the rug again and again. And I believe now that we've seen, you know, the recent turmoil in the publication of all these gay marriages being done by United Methodist ministers, Bishop Talbert coming out saying, we no longer have an obligation to be obedient to the discipline, and he openly calls for gay marriages and for bishops and pastors to perform them and to ordain, you know, gays and lesbians. And in my trial especially, I think I became like the lightning rod. I mean, the tension had grown so much behind the scenes that at my trial, you know, you saw all the political powers active in my trial. And so after I was defrocked, it really caused an uproar in the church on the progressive side that has really taken a toll on the church overall. And I think now we're at a place where even the hierarchy of the church is no longer denying that we're very much divided over this issue. And now we're actually talking. Now we're actually dialoguing. And so we still have like a year and a half until General Conference. I'm really hoping that something can happen. But the other question that you had was about when did these homophobic laws enter into the discipline? It was only in the year, 1972? It was 1972 is when, for the very first time, you know, this sentence appeared that the practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teachings. And the interesting fact about that is that, you know, some of our Methodists will say, well, but this is the traditional teaching of the church. And then I remind them, no, it's not. You know, we are adhering to the traditional teaching of the church, which had nothing like this, nothing of the homophobic language. It didn't enter until 1972. And there was one more thing I wanted to say. Yeah, it'll come to me later. But did that answer your question?
Yes. Yeah.
Hi. Thank you very much for that wonderful, inspiring talk. I noticed that 6 years went by from the time that you performed this, and it was only when your congregation sort of stirred things up that the trial actually happened. Is there a Methodist version of, like, don't ask, don't tell that's going on that kind of got shaken up? Is that kind of how they're handling it?
That's a very good description of that, and that's what I tried to communicate also with that bit of about the fear. You know, it's so evident. You know, progressives in the United Methodist Church, and there are a lot of them, even among the pastors, even among the district superintendents and bishops, are fearful. And I saw it also in the aftermath of my trial. Bishop Johnson, for instance, had a statement that was so beautiful that she gave as a response to a petition. She said things like, the laws that Pastor Frank was defrocked over are discriminatory. She called for a moratorium, for no more trials on this issue until we dialogue and maybe change some things. 24 hours later, her statement was reversed on the annual conference's webpage. The same happened with Bishop McClee. He had this awesome statement, and all of a sudden, 24 hours later, the statement was changed on his annual conference's webpage. So, you know, you see this fear operating behind the scenes, how pressure is applied to people, and all of a sudden, they change their minds, they change their statements, you know. It's incredible. There is a real fear factor here that's at work, and I think what you said, the don't tell... What was it? The don't ask, don't tell. That's probably really what's going on behind the scenes, and that's really what was going on in my case too, when the my bishop and my district superintendent never acted on any of this until there was a complaint, and then they felt they had to.
Yes. Thank you for sharing your story with us today. I have a question about the other ministers you mentioned who are performing same-sex marriages. Have they been defrocked? Have any other ministers been defrocked? And what about the church, the United Methodist Church in California, that is more welcoming than in the Northeast? Have any of those ministers performed same-sex marriages, and what has been the result?
Yes. The good news is same-sex marriages happen all the time in the United Methodist Church, and have for a long time. More and more pastors are coming out and saying, oh, I performed a same-sex marriage. There is one every week who publishes his or her story on the Mind blog. That's a part of the New York Annual Conference. Every week, one pastor's story gets published. Dean Snyder, my pastor at Foundry, he was at my trial, and he was standing in the back talking to the reporters there. I was told, I didn't hear this myself, and he was bragging about how he performed like 20 same-sex marriages in everybody's presence. And I think it's becoming, people are encouraged and lose, you know, that fear factor and lose that fear and are coming out now on how they performed same-sex weddings. And it's a beautiful thing. And the Western jurisdiction as a whole, not just California, but the whole West, actually has agreed not to pursue any trials based on same-sex weddings or any LGBT-related issue. And so just recently there were two ministers that had openly performed same-sex marriages. This is like 6-7 weeks ago. And so it was Bishop Agaya? I'm not sure who it was now. But one of the bishops in the Western District had has just dealt with this administratively and has given those pastors 24-hour suspensions. And there wasn't even a trial. So that's how they deal with that on the West Coast. And I call that a vacation, actually, 24-hour suspension.
Hi. I was just wondering what happened to the former members of your, or the members of your former congregation that were LGBT and the supporters. Did they feel they had to leave in protest, or are they still fighting the good fight, or what exactly happened?
They did hang on for a while. When my assistant was still there, who was very much on the same page, they were still coming to the church, and it turned out that after I left, after I was basically fired, this political group, these 25, 30 people, turned against her, and it got so much for her that she quit. She couldn't do it any longer, and that's when all of my former supporters also left the church. So it is so sad to see, this whole ministry sort of fold and all those wonderful people leave the church, and they're, they don't even know where to go, some of them, There you go, yeah. But the nearest one is in Harrisburg, so that's quite a drive, yeah. Oh, we should start one in Lebanon.
Next question's here.
Hi, I was, my mother had me confirmed in the Westminster Methodist Church. It wasn't United back in those days yet. And the preacher was absolutely wonderful. I think he had a great rapport with kids, and he would come to counsel people in their homes with deaths, and there were a lot of deaths in my family. So he just simply had some kind of warmth that percolated through. And I'm wondering if there was some, how high up the higher-ups were who had him railroaded when it was discovered he was having an affair and he was tarred and feathered and was no more. So I just wondered how up the food chain that happened back in the 50s.
I'm the wrong person to ask that because I wasn't around then. So I really don't know what, I just heard some horrendous stories yesterday. A former United Methodist minister was telling me how some pastors were actually, they faced a trial and they were dismissed and defrocked because of playing cards or for swearing and stuff like that. So that sounds horrible. Or drinking maybe, yeah. That sounds horrible. But yeah, those kind of things happened.
1976, he said.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. That's right. He did say that. Yeah. And, oh, yeah, and that reminds me, I never answered that question. There were others that were defrocked as well. Jimmy Creech was the very first one in 1999 who was defrocked because he performed a same-sex marriage. And Jimmy was the speaker at my benefit concert, and I got to know him personally then, and he's become like a spiritual father to me. And he's been there every step of the way through my trial. It was just amazing. I remember finding an email from him after I was found guilty on that day, and all it said was, "Dear Frank, I know how you feel. Love, Jimmy." And I just lost it when I saw that. I just felt so supported by him throughout. So, and there are others. Beth Stroud was probably the last one who got defrocked before me, and she, of course, got defrocked because she is as the discipline calls it, a self-avowed practicing homosexual minister. So she got defrocked over that, which to me, that's even more horrible because she wasn't defrocked on account of something she did, but of who she is created to be. And I can't even imagine what that's like, for her. And I talked with her as well many times, but that is even more horrible.
Anyone else? Last questions before? Oh, thank you.
Like to ask you, Frank, how you're supporting yourself and your family now.
That's a very good question. Yeah, it feels like our life is like a whirlwind still, since all of this stuff happened, and all of a sudden we find ourselves, traveling a lot, and it's just a totally different life. But we are holding up. We are meeting so many supporters like yourselves and friends that support us, and that's a beautiful thing. that helps tremendously. And we do try to find spaces and times in between our travels where we just have fun as a family. You know, like this last time we were all together was Christmas. That was actually the very first Christmas ever that we were all together, worshiping together and sitting in one pew, because I'd always had Christmas services to do, even when the kids were little, and it felt great. And we had such a great time together. That was just a half a year ago.
That question was a good segue into the reminder that there is a container on the back table for any of you who would like to make a contribution to Frank and his family and their cause. Anyone else? All right, I think we will call this a very great thank you, Frank, for your support today.
Oh, thank you, guys. Thank you.